From 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh hosted the first ever White House Frontiers Conference.
It's precisely at those moments when we've got real challenges, when we double down on new solutions.
What innovative strides are next for the city and the country? Pittsburgh is tops among benchmark cities for residents with a high school diploma, but near the bottom when it comes to a bachelor's degree.
We have yet another disadvantage to sort of overcome as we go about matching talent with the demand or employers with job seekers.
We'll discuss the impact on our current and future workforce needs and a legislative proposal to significantly reform Pennsylvania's charter school laws. That's all ahead on our weekly news roundup. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. A new report looks at the education credentials of Pittsburgh area residents, but how do they sync with the employer's needs? Auditor General Eugene DePasquale recently called Pennsylvania's charter school law the worst in the nation. A Senate committee held a hearing Thursday on proposed major reforms to those laws. That's coming up on The Confluence, but first...
Because innovation is not a luxury that we do away with when we're tightening our belts. It's precisely at those moments when we've got real challenges, when we double down on new solutions that can lead to new jobs and new industries and a stronger economy.
That was President Obama, of course, yesterday addressing the first White House Frontiers Conference hosted by the University of Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, and the White House. Joining us to talk about it, Aaron Opperly, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome, Aaron.
Thanks for having me.
And Sean Hamill, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Sean, welcome to you.
Happy to be here.
Okay, if you have a question or a comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. Gentlemen, the opening of a Star Trek episode referred to space as the final frontier. Well, the president told the crowd of scientists, innovators, engineers, educators, entrepreneurs, and others who were gathered that the future is theirs to create on a variety of frontiers. He just laid it all out there, Sean.
He did, and I mean, that was really goes to the heart of what this conference was about. There was no tangible report that's coming out of this. There's no follow-up. There's no promise of a second conference with the next president, whoever that may be. And that really was the charge that from the get-go that it is up to you, those folks in the audience, these very, very smart, big thinkers who are there both on the panel and in the audience, which was one of my big takeaways from this. Like, they made this audience list as much a set of luminaries as those on the panel. I mean, so you had, you know, prolific, well-known stars like Dean Kamen, who invented Segway, on a panel. You had Red Whitaker, the famed robotics professor at CMU. But noticed walking around at the roundtables when they just had the audiences get together to talk about the topics. I mean, it was president of this nonprofit, CEO of this startup that you may not have heard of, but the stories they were telling about what they do and what they hope to do in the future were huge. And there did seem to be some of that legitimate energy that he was hoping, and the White House said officially they were hoping would come out of this. That was what they charged them with.
I mean, it's no doubt that President Obama is a geek, a nerd. He admitted to it during his speech. And so the conference really felt like a chance for him to celebrate innovations that have happened during his 8 years, sort of cementing a legacy as an innovator for him. But I think he made some important steps to keep this going. There were, you know, these public-private partnerships that are sort of happening outside of government that would sort of keep going no matter what administration comes in next. And he kind of had a message saying, hey, look, don't mess this up. We've made a lot of progress in 8 years, and let's keep that going.
And that was one of the interesting things about the whole thing, too. Like, that was another stated mission. Like, let's keep this going. We've put money into it. We've set up partnerships. And when we were deciding on doing these stories, I brought out this idea that the White House had told us that there might be a serendipity moment at this, too. It's something you can't plan. And our business editor, Teresa Lindemann, said, yeah, maybe they're hoping for a what if Tesla met Einstein moment. You know, and who knows? And I certainly, in these roundtables and then over lunch and then afterwards, you saw all these peoples, many of whom had never met, if not most of them, and you saw those conversations happening. So what tangible thing comes out of that in the near future or distant future? We may not know for a long time, but you know, hopefully there was. Maybe some solution we learn about 10 years from now to some huge problem was because two people who had never met before came to Pittsburgh.
Well, Aaron mentioned that the president called himself a science geek, a nerd. He seemed to enjoy himself. Is this just because his presidency is winding down, or this is what he really likes? Aaron?
I think it's what he really likes. He's held science fairs, maker fairs, astronomy nights at the White House throughout his 8 years. He's, you know, he's mentioned science, innovation, technology in every State of the Union address. I think he really is. He's a huge Trekkie. He said The Martian was his favorite movie of last year. So I think this is really who he is. And I got to spend time with the president as he walked through the exhibit hall, meeting Nathan Copeland, docking a spaceship at the ISS, seeing the SpaceX Dragon capsule. You could just tell he was psyched about this. This was cool stuff. He got to be there, and he got to be a part of it.
Well, there was, you know, that was one of the questions that we asked the White House several times. John Holdren, who's the head of the Office of Science and Technology Policy. And I was asking him, was it just reflecting back on his, or because of what you see in the press releases, was this also sort of a reminder that the previous administration had what they consider not put science in its quote-unquote rightful place? Every press release they put out about this, both in August and now, includes that some similar phrase from the president about our effort. And he mentioned last night, he pointed out during his initial inaugural address, our effort to put science back to its rightful place as if it had been removed previously. And they toe-stepped around that a little bit when you'd ask direct, are you, is that a knock on the Bush administration? And they wouldn't go there directly, but they said, no, well, we're just saying that we think it's in its rightful place now.
I want to talk a little bit more about a couple of things that you gentlemen brought up, and one was the space capsule at CMU, and also you mentioned Nathan Copeland. He even did a fist bump with Nathan Copeland's robotic arm.
It was an amazing moment. The president spent a lot of time.
Well, who is Nathan Copeland?
Nathan Copeland. He's a quadriplegic man from Fayette County. He was paralyzed in an accident when he was 18. A team at University of Pittsburgh and UPMC, through a grant, through some DARPA funding, have created a robotic arm for him that he can control with his mind. He controls it like it's his own arm. When he thinks, I want to, you know, make a fist, the arm makes a fist. And when someone pushes on the hand or touches the fingers, he can feel those sensations. So it's like having an arm back. And so they showcased that technology there. And the president spent a lot of time with Nathan, talking to him, touching his hand. They were shaking hands. He even turned to the press pool and said, you know, you guys know how this works because this is amazing. And it's quite the technology. And so then the two fist bumped. And Nathan took it a step further. And after fist bumping the president, he blew it up. He threw his hand open, which when you think about it, that's a pretty complex movement. So it was quite a moment to see, and lucky to be there.
Sean, you talked about who the next president might be and whether this moves along. President did talk about, and he said, talked about a need for a commitment to innovation to be institutionalized. In other words, passed along, not just stopped at the end of 2016, at the end of one particular presidency.
Well, again, we don't know who's going to be president, but it's hard to institutionalize everything. And I think sidestepping that, he talked about trying to continue to inspire and energize. And that was, again, another one of my takeaways. I was on the local track part of the conference where it was a little bit of a hodgepodge of different ideas. They had a panel on autonomous cars and urban transportation. They had a panel on criminal justice and how big data can help you with that. Then they had a series of lightning panels where people talked specifically about some of the projects they're working on. And every single one of them was amazing. I promise most people have never heard of Streetwise, a CEO named Antwi Acom, who just wowed the crowd. He had 3 minutes to do it, but he talks about ground truthing with big data. So he's developed an app that takes big data and makes use local neighborhood resources to figure out if it's applicable. He put up a map of what the state of California said were the number of grocery stores in East Oakland, a poor neighborhood in Oakland. And it was dotted really well. And he said it makes it look like a food oasis. There's tons of options. But using ground truthing, his app figured out it really wasn't that. There were only like four grocery stores in the entire section. And the crowd was amazed, looking at that going, yeah, that's what we need. We need to get stuff done. And these are the kind of efforts that are going to do it. And that's not funded by the federal government. And a lot of the projects we heard about were not funded by the federal government. There's a lot of energy out there. And maybe inevitably there's so much inertia in this field, data and innovation side, it's going to continue anyway.
Well, you bring up something I wanted to get to, and that was, you know, people might say, all this is neat, the caps, the space capsule, the Dragon X, and the also the robotic arm and some other developments and even interplanetary travel, et cetera. But they might be saying, how does this affect me? Well, the National Department of Transportation announced Thursday that Pittsburgh received an $11 million grant for advanced technology transportation projects.
One focus of our current research is integrating adaptive signal control with connected vehicles. The last expansion we made of the network, we also installed designated short-range communication radios at 24 intersections. These are the radios that are going to start going into cars in 2017 and allow the intersections to talk directly with the vehicles. The basic application here is greater safety. Our interest is more in using communicated information to enhance mobility.
That was Stephen Smith, director of CMU's Intelligent Coordination and Logistics Lab. So the grant will help solve traffic flow issues. Transportation is one where people, the everyday person, can sort of identify with. Yeah, if it helps me get through that intersection more quickly or whatever. So transportation, you found out, was one of those areas.
It's a huge area. I mean, there's just, as we all well know here in Pittsburgh, you can't drive around anywhere near downtown without running into one of those test autonomous cars from Uber. I mean, this stuff is happening rapidly. And it was interesting because the panel that they had on this issue, autonomous vehicles, urban transportation, had the Secretary of Transportation, Anthony Fox, the co-founder of Zipcar, the founder of Zook, which is a company trying to build autonomous cars and get them going, and then Bill Peduto. And so they came from completely different perspectives, ideals, one big picture, one local picture, and two companies. And they all had the same vision of where all this is going. And and they believe it's real, that eventually to make cities work as people move into them, we've got to get people out of their own personal car. The number several times was pointed out that your car sits 90% of its time idle, either parked in a garage or at your home, and it's not being used. And that's a waste of space, both at your home and in the garage. So either ride-sharing, autonomous vehicles that are cheaper, more efficient, and a heck of a lot safer. I mean, they threw out numbers galore about the reduction in accidents and serious injury and death. And the crowd, looking around at the crowd, they're all sort of nodding like, yeah, that is our future. It seems distant now, but there are a lot of companies there right now that are already integrating some of that work, including here in Pittsburgh on traffic signalization, again, the Uber cars. We've got subways that by and large could run themselves. This isn't as distant. I mean, it's within many of certainly my kids' lifetime. It sounds like the way they're talking about it, we're going to see it.
And some of the transportation developments are even much sooner than that, including putting these devices in Port Authority buses next year to hook up with traffic signals. So if no traffic is heading in the opposite direction or the cross direction, that will move traffic through. And this is building upon with several streets that are already intersections in East Liberty that are already have sensors in the traffic systems. Gentlemen, we have just about a minute left, less than a minute left. I do want to get to you, your thoughts on the president said, there's no doubt we're going to be able to make enormous strides and amazing possibilities are ahead of us. So from your observations, what can we look at for innovative strides, do you think, whether it's locally or nationally or whatever? Aaron?
I think we're going to see a lot in space exploration, and that's an area where it's exciting. You know, the president has said he wants to go to Mars. There's plans in place to go to Mars. You're going to see the commercial industry really take off in the next couple of years, and it's fun to be thinking about space again, and it's fun that we're looking in that direction.
Big data was something that was brought up at every part, every track in the conference, taking massive amounts of numbers that reflect a criminal justice issue, a health issue, a traffic issue, and our ability to deal with a larger and larger data set and have it tell us something. And there are a lot of people in all those rooms who are spending a lot of time on that and already showing tangible results, and it's only going to get better in the future.
Sean Hamill is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Aaron Opperle is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune-Review. Gentlemen, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
A new report shows Pittsburgh has a high level of residents 25 and older with high school diplomas, but a low rate of residents with bachelor's degrees. How is that impacting our workforce needs? That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. New data reported this week by Pittsburgh Today shows that the Pittsburgh region has the highest percentage of high school graduates, including equivalency, among 16 benchmark regions for residents 25 or older. However, it's the second to last in the category of having some college but no degree among that same age group, 25 and older. To discuss this data and what it means to our current employment situation and how it might impact our workforce future needs, we've invited Doug Hoik, Program Director for Pittsburgh Today. Doug, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Kevin. Great to be here.
And James Futrell, Vice President of Market Research for the Allegheny Conference and Community Development. Jim, welcome.
Thanks.
All right. If you have a question or a comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. Does there seem to be a disconnect between a couple of those findings that I mentioned? Pittsburgh at the top in terms of percentage of residents with high school diplomas, but near the bottom of percentage when it comes to having some college experience. We'll start with you, Doug.
Well, it's in terms of the high school, just the history, and Jim and I were talking about this. I think the reason we have such a high percentage of people with a high school degree is, I mean, this is a traditional, relatively conservative place where people follow the rules. You know, they do what's expected. You see it in our low crime rate. I mean, our social fabric is relatively more intact here. I think that's why you have such a high level of high school degree completion. When you start looking at the higher levels of degrees, such as bachelor's degrees, we're, you know, 11th out of 15, and bachelor's degrees here were never, you know, in aggregate, when you're looking at the metropolitan statistical area, you know, a bunch of counties, bachelor's degrees historically were not necessary here because the nature of the lucrative nature of mill work. Why get a degree if you could go right into the mills? So historically, that's been the case here for probably a century.
Yeah, that is true. And I think it's interesting to note that once you get away from kind of the aggregate numbers and look at it by various age groups, you do see that our educational attainment does tend to skew more towards college-educated people in like the 25 to 44-year-old group. So I think it speaks to how the region has evolved over the last 40 years or so.
Is the factor that we do have an older population, and this category is 25 and older, and maybe a lot of those 70 and 80-year-olds who are still residents, maybe that was just it. They went to high school and stopped.
Absolutely. That reflects our industrial past. If you look at the category of people who have a graduate or professional degree, interestingly, we are right about at the benchmark average. Mm-hmm. Now, that's telling you that there's been a change happening. It shows, you know, the sophistication of the eds and meds and the more kind of world-class segment of our society. So we're going through demographic changes here. It's been a long process, but in that latter thing, graduate and professional degrees, you're really seeing the changing Pittsburgh.
Yeah, that is true. And if you do even break it down further to like a 25 to 44-year-old age group, we do have one of the most highly educated workforces in the country up there with Boston and Washington.
Okay, so we have high school diploma up high, some college down low among the benchmarks regions, advanced degree, so master's or above, close to the benchmark average, near the middle of the pack. But when it comes to associate degrees, I think we're number two of these. What are we seeing here? Has there been an emphasis on community college and post-high school, but not necessarily four-year college, or what?
Jim may have a better sense of that. I would throw in just one little thing regarding the next level up that you mentioned, where we're not doing well in terms of some college. My guess, and it's just a guess, is that people here, if they're going to decide to go to college, they're relatively more likely to finish it. In terms of associate's degrees, certainly there's a big emphasis that kids, in order to be successful in our economy, don't need necessarily a traditional four-year degree. I know the conference, has all sorts of jobs open where they need people who have skills and proficiencies that you can get with a different kind of degree.
A couple months ago released a study called Inflection Point, where we took a look at the future workforce needs. And I think one of the findings that was most surprised to people is that most of the jobs that will be created in the future do not require a four-year degree, but they do require some level of post-secondary training, either through an associate program or a certificate program. So I think that, again, speaks to the nature of the workforce. We have a very old workforce in the manufacturing and utility segments, and as those people retire, while there won't be a one-to-one match, as technology advances, the people that they bring in are going to require a much higher level of technical skills.
You mentioned the report. According to the report, and looking ahead to the next 10 years, the Pittsburgh region's workforce will undergo a complete and dramatic transformation due to worker retirements, economic growth, and occupational transitions. Vera Kravchuk, Chief Strategy Officer for Three Rivers Workforce Investment Board, says right now the numbers aren't adding up.
We have less people in the pipeline. We have more older people who have a lot of educational background and experiences, and they will be leaving with all this capital labor market soon. And so knowing that the next generation, it's smaller in terms of the absolute numbers.
Jim, you were saying about those numbers.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the things that the study did help us identify, is that there is the skills mismatch. And that as a region, we really have to work to make sure that the people coming out of the educational system have the skills that are going to be needed by the jobs that are being created in the future.
Okay. So the current supply of workers, is it going to be insufficient? Is it a matter of attracting, keeping people, young people who come here to Pittsburgh, to one of our fine colleges, universities, keeping them here? Is it a matter of also recruiting people from other parts of the country and even doing a better job recruiting immigrants?
It's all of those things. Regions across the country as baby boomers age are going to be facing the same issue, albeit not as acutely as we will, because we had such an exodus of people, in the early 80s era, and they took with them their future children. So we're also relatively the whitest of, the big cities. So our birth rates are not going to be as high as other regions which have a more, multiracial complexion, so to speak. So we have to, labor force, we have to do all those things you said. We have to attract people, we have to keep people. But we also, labor forces are mobile, they're fluid. Where there are jobs, people tend to go. We will probably, I'm speculating, need to be more attractive wage-wise. Even though our cost of living is low, that doesn't necessarily, a young person doesn't necessarily take that in the equation.
We have to attract more people. We have to retain more people. One of the core opportunities is our post-secondary education system. We have 61 post-secondary education institutions in the region that graduate about 40,000 people a year. The study identified that we only retain about 50% of those, or a third of the people with a bachelor's degree or higher. So that's a prime area where we can help build the workforce in the future. There's also would be very important is what we call the elevate segment, where people who have traditionally fallen out of the workforce, working to develop programs to get them back into the workforce.
There's also, Kevin, I just want to add one thing. There's also the component of fun. Why do people go to Austin? My youngest son's in Austin. Well, it's a good job there. But why, you know, why are people, 150 new people going to Austin every day? Because it's, you know, it has a great buzz and it's a fun place to be. Denver the same way. Denver's not a great education system place. But college, it just is a huge net attractor of college graduates because they want to be there because of the natural surroundings and there's a fun vibe. That's something we should also build.
Okay, so where were we, if there were a fun index on those benchmark regions, where are we going to fall, Doug?
No comment.
This is a predictive.
I don't know. We'll come up with that.
Okay, but does that lead to, okay, the younger, the college grads, they go to have fun, but maybe they sort of come back home when it's time for family or whatever,
and
or
Pittsburgh's,
not?
Pittsburgh's perceived as much more fun than it used to be. I mean, with
absolutely,
the nightlife,
yeah,
the restaurants, and so on. It's something to build on, I think.
No, I've been in this job for 14 years, and we have found that recruiting talent is a lot easier now than it was a decade ago. Yeah.
All right. Let's listen again to Vera Kravchuk of the Workforce Investment Board. She told us that right now it does seem to be difficult to replace the talent that will be retiring.
But also grow the economy, especially around the jobs where the most potential is, which is the high-end tech jobs that we hear from employers. They would love to grow more here. They are ready to bring more jobs here, but the talent is simply not here.
So is the issue, is the problem just raw numbers of workers available, or is it the specific talents and skills that they will need?
Well, it is a raw numbers question on the one hand, the, you know, the projections of retirees versus the people available in the workforce. In terms of skills, I mean, again, Jim's probably better to answer this, but the conference, you know, there are X number, 20-some thousand jobs that are available, and there appears, you know, to be a skills gap in that regard.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the trends we saw emerging in the study was that this whole notion of the hybridization of jobs. For instance, a registered nurse not only has to be an expert in patient care, but there's now a customer service element to it. There is a technology element to it. So the skills needed for a lot of these traditional positions are growing.
We have less than 2 minutes left, and I want to bring it back to education. We started this discussion talking about the education levels of Pittsburgh area residents. I remember talking with the then head of the Three Rivers Workforce Investment Board, this is about a decade or so ago, about the importance of better connections between employers and the region's educators down to middle school. It seems like we're hearing almost a similar message now, a decade or so later. Jim, we're done?
I think this has been a ongoing challenge. I think it's our hope that the inflection point study will draw greater attention to it. I think a lot of the employers in the region are realizing the challenges that we face and are taking a fresh look at things.
In terms of education, I think it also bears keeping in mind that we cannot afford to have the numbers of kids who are, for instance, dropping out of school. I mean, this is obviously it's a tough, pernicious problem across the country. However, in Pittsburgh, it's a place that's relatively small. We have the resources and the intellectual and will wherewithal to solve this problem, I think perhaps better than other regions. And we certainly have the impetus given our need for workforce.
Okay, very quickly, 10-year projection. Is it too late? Do we have enough time to bring in, have a qualified workforce so that these jobs and companies say, we can't find it here, we're leaving? Jim?
Definitely. I think we have the assets and the will to do it. I think the future looks bright.
Yeah, Pittsburgh's never been more attractive. I think absolutely.
All righty. Doug Hoik is the program director for Pittsburgh Today. Jim Futrell is vice president of market research at the Allegheny Conference on Community Development. Gentlemen, thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Kevin.
A recent audit found that the Pennsylvania Department of Education's oversight of payments to charter schools is insufficient. A hearing was held yesterday on major reforms to the state's charter school laws. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. There are more than 1.7 million students enrolled in Pennsylvania schools. About 130,000 attend charter schools, basically taking with them a per-student state appropriation from public school districts. At least that's what the public school districts would tell you. The Senate Democratic Policy Committee held a hearing yesterday in Monroeville on the role of charter schools, and we're going to discuss what came out of that hearing and the whole charter school issue with Molly Bourne, education reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, Molly.
Thanks for having me.
And reporter Mary Niederberger, who was covering this whole issue for Public Source.
Yes.
Okay. If you have a comment or a question, please, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. In August, Auditor General DePasquale released an audit of the Department of Education's oversight of payments to charters. He called it insufficient. He called Pennsylvania's charter school law the worst in the nation. Do we know what it is that is indeed the worst law, or is that a comment of reflective if Mr. DePasquale just doesn't like charter schools?
Okay, what he was referring to, and some of this came up at the hearing yesterday, is that the charter schools don't operate with the same kind of transparency that public schools do. They can form foundations that purchase buildings, lease them back to the schools. Public schools can't do that kind of stuff. They're also talking about how the charter schools automatically get paid for what they say are the number of students that are in their schools, and the districts can't really dispute that. They have to make the payment, and then it takes them months later in order to get reimbursed.
There was something else he mentioned, I believe it was in August, that millions of public dollars are paid to charter school landlords, and he called for the state to look more closely to monitor those lease payments. And he mentioned some of that yesterday in his testimony in Monroeville.
Because some of the people who own the buildings sit on the boards of the charter schools. And exactly. That's what the Auditor General really doesn't like.
So was yesterday's hearing a result of this audit by DePasquale's office? Or has this been brewing for a while, ever since the charters first appeared?
This has been brewing.
Go ahead, Molly.
This has been brewing from the beginning.
Yeah, I would say, I think it was earlier this month that Senator Brewster unveiled some charter reform proposals. I think Mary will talk a little bit about that. And he cited a lot of the results of Mr. DePasquale's audit in those line-by-line proposals.
But he has also cited other things. Like he wants a moratorium on the approval of new cyber charter schools. He wants all of the teachers in charter schools to have to be certified. He also wants there to be limits on brick-and-mortar charter schools. If they draw from more than one district, he wants them to have to get charter approval from multiple districts. These are new proposals, but it's an old argument. Mr. Brewster made it very clear that he's on the side of the traditional public schools and the rules that they fulfill in the community.
I think it would help, too, to just put some numbers in context. There are about 160 brick-and-mortar charter schools in Pennsylvania. There are 20 in Allegheny County, and there's 14 cyber charter schools.
That's across the cybers are across the state.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. So let's talk a little bit more about the testimony yesterday. No surprise, for instance, the McKeesport area school district super it was talking about the charter schools are the top financial problem for public schools. The Woodland Hills super, Alan Johnson, added that his school district will spend nearly $15 million of its $90 million budget on charter school tuition. And then let's start with that. So there's no surprise in that. And is it really all about the money?
It is all about the money. Mr. Brewster even said at one point in time that perhaps we shouldn't even be funding charter schools from public schools, that there should be a separate pot of money to fund charter schools rather than see the money leave the traditional public school and go to the charter schools. It's all about money.
Deputy Secretary Matthew Stem from the Pennsylvania Department of Education mentioned yesterday in his testimony that the department will create a division of charter schools, which I thought was really interesting.
But not a separate budget necessarily?
No.
No. So what would this division mean? We don't know yet, so that's a floating the idea out there.
If I recall, they mentioned something. I know they would have staff that would be dedicated to both brick and mortar and cyber charters. I believe I remember a criticism during the testimony yesterday that the charters weren't necessarily included in some conversations about how that office would run, and I think they were hopeful that would happen in the future.
Was most of this yesterday, or all of it, about the brick and mortar charters? Or how much did cybers come up?
It was about both, and there seemed to be a clear agreement in the room that cybers, I don't know if I want to use the word, were worse, but they were bigger offenders in terms of educational quality and also in terms of funding, because they get the same funding per student as the brick and mortars do, and yet they don't have to maintain a facility.
Is that what you sensed?
Yeah, and I think you and Mary covered this for the Post-Gazette, some the conviction of the PA cyber head, Nick Trombetta. I think that wasn't that long ago. It's still top of mind for a lot of folks.
So are the charter people on the same side, whether it's brick and mortar and cyber, or do they see themselves as separate entities in a sense when it comes to people's reaction, state lawmakers' reaction to what they do?
I will note that there were no representatives from cyber charters at the hearing yesterday, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't think there were. I think I think Senator Brewster said he wanted to focus on the brick and mortar.
That's right. But certainly the cyber issue did come up.
Came up how so, in terms of were the brick and mortar pointing the finger somewhere else or what?
The brick and mortar folks, Jeremy Resnick, who runs the highly Propel. Successful Propel schools around here, said that he believed that the cyber charters should have their own regulations because they weren't even the same type of entity as the brick and mortar charter schools. That's the first time I've heard someone say that.
Okay. Is it Ron Sofo?
Yes, City Charter.
A City Charter CEO. He countered, because we were talking about the superintendent of Woodland Hills and also McKeesport area. Mr. Sofo countered that his school provides a quality education at, quote, $6,000 to $8,000 less per pupil than our authorizing school district, and that in this case would be Pittsburgh Public Schools. Is it a claim that can be backed up? Do we know? I mean, the cost per?
It's a claim that probably can be backed up, but there are so many factors to take into consideration. For example, charter schools don't have unionized teachers, so they can pay teachers what they want to pay teachers. Charter schools also have the option of sending students back to their regular public district if they have extraordinary disciplinary issues or special education needs. And school districts can't do that. They have to educate everyone. So it's very likely that a charter school can do it for less money, but they may not be addressing all the same issues and working under the same framework as a traditional public school.
Now, you mentioned State Senator Jim Brewster. He's the one that asked the Democratic Policy Committee to hold this hearing in Monroeville yesterday. And we talked a little bit about some of the changes he's proposed. Are there some that, and will these all be packaged in one piece of legislation? Do we know yet if there are plans for multiple bills and maybe, oh, I'll get this one, I won't get that one? What do we know about how this legislation, these proposals, will be packaged?
I'm not sure, and I don't think that came up yesterday. But certainly his position on charters was clear, as Mary mentioned. And I'd like to, if I could, there was one really interesting exchange between him and Anthony Perillo, who runs a Montessori charter school up in Erie. I was really, really struck by this conversation. Senator Brewster essentially said, you know, the way to ruin a community is by taking away its public school. You can't market that community. If businesses or families come in, it's really hard to incentivize them if their school's in receivership or something, for example. And this issue hits close to home for him, and you could tell yesterday. He represents areas of Allegheny and Westmoreland counties and parts of the Mon Valley communities. And he asked actually directly to Mr. Perillo, you know, if I'm paraphrasing here, but if I said to you you may be the cause for the failure and eventual closing of 15 school districts. What would you say to that? And I just thought that was a really striking question. 15 likely refers to the number of school districts within the area that he represents. And Mr. Perrello said, you know, it's that his outcome is about the community, that if you have good schools, whether they're in the district, traditional public school or charters, people will come. And that zip code doesn't doom your life as it does in traditional schools.
Mary, 15 seconds. I'm sorry. Is there a proposal by Senator Brewster that has the best chance of passage, do you think?
We don't know what the proposal is yet, but I would just say a lot of times what legislators do is sort of throw the spaghetti against the wall and see what'll stick. He can put everything in here and then negotiate later.
All right. Reporter Mary Niederberger covering this story for Public Source. Molly Bourne, education reporter for the Post-Gazette. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
And finally, what's ahead? What better way to get ready for Halloween than a walk through a cemetery? Don't worry, you won't be alone. Guided tours of the historical, as in 135-year-old Homewood Cemetery, are being offered tomorrow, including a stroll through Millionaire's Row, where notable Pittsburghers, including Henry J. Hines and Michael Benedum, are buried. And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley, production assistants from Vince Balestrino, the producer of the program, Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.